This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein has the day off. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a movie review from Matt O'Lean, the latest in the Mad Max series, Furiosa. But we are going to start today with a very different kind of art. Imagine driving through a small town and checking out an arts festival and coming across a voice like this. I know, we all pretend we can sing like that, at least in the shower, or maybe that's just me. That is just a tiny clip from Iron Opera. This is a new documentary exploring big dreams in a small town. It is showing on Thursday at 9 o'clock Central right here on Prairie Public. And I am joined now by Mike Schultz, the director, producer, editor, writer, and probably seven more other titles when it comes to productions like that. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So, how did you find out about this big Italian opera production that is happening in the town of Aurora, Minnesota, and throughout parts of the Iron Range? And by the way, the population of Aurora is 1,600, mm-hmm. give or take.
Yeah, there's an A&W restaurant, so okay. that's how I gauge population. So it's okay. Got to be at least 1,000, you know. I'm a little embarrassed. I live in Duluth. I live just outside of Duluth, and I had not heard of the Northern Lights Music Festival before.
That's pretty Iron Rangey to not know about.
there is a bit of a cultural difference sometimes between Duluth and the Iron Range. They almost have, you know, different things going on at all times. So, you know, we've got a great opera company here in Duluth, Lyric Opera of the North, and I was familiar with them. But someone at our local PBS station here in Duluth told me, did you know there's an opera company that is on the Iron Range? And I couldn't imagine like a more delightful dichotomy of things. You know, we think of the Iron Range as this very industrial,
people who are working
locale.
Their butts off.
Yeah, you know, there's mines, but there's also, you know, timber, and there's all this work going on up there. But it's also, you know, as I started to research it, it's one of the most heavily educated rural areas in America. So it's such an interesting culture up there, and they have managed to keep this opera company, and this Northern Lights Music Festival is kind of the deal at the center of this, which does chamber music and orchestral pieces. They've kept this going for, I think, like over 15 years now.
Yeah. Give us a sense of this background, because there is a very specific immigration pattern that led to that sort of blending of culture and that higher education that you mentioned.
Yeah, because they have the mines up there, they got a much wider, number of countries, people emigrating to that area. They were there for the work, obviously. But, you know, a lot of parts of, you know, I grew up in Fargo-Moorhead, and it seems like, you know, we just got Scandinavians, a lot of Scandinavians there. And the Iron Range, I've heard it described as the Upper East Side of New York, as if it were just lifted up and dropped into a forest. There is, and I think someone in the film actually describes it that way.
And I will say, there were every name, I was like, I wouldn't have known how to pronounce that by just looking at the names of the people, most of the people in the show, in a lot of ways.
Yep. It's true. So all of these, you know, people came over here, and they wanted to make sure their kids were well educated. So the Iron Range, mostly funded by the mines, has some of the most beautiful schools I have ever seen in all of my travels. And with these schools, they have beautiful auditoriums. Like, these auditoriums on the Iron Range are like opera houses.
Yeah. The drapery, the seatings, all of this is just astonishingly beautiful. And I was also shocked. And I grew up, you know, not too far outside of Minneapolis, and then moved to Walhalla, North Dakota for a later part of childhood. And go to that part of the state, I also didn't know.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite parts of Minnesota to go and find stories for documentaries and things like that.
Oh, I bet.
Really interesting there with the mix of people who've moved there.
We're visiting today with filmmaker Mike Schultz. He is the creative force behind Iron Opera. This is a documentary showing at 9 p.m. Central right here on Prairie Public that explores a full-fledged Italian opera that is staged throughout the Iron Range in Minnesota, including some very, very tiny towns. And I want to play another clip from the show because it really highlights some of the diversity of voices and accents that you're going to hear, and then introduces, you know, what I would say is the central theme of Iron Opera.
Yeah, I've been a part of this opera for years, and I still run into people. You do an opera here? It's crazy.
It's an Italian opera in the middle of Minnesota. It is a little weird, but it's also fascinating, and it's fun.
Big dreams, small town, right? That's a song or something.
This is a very interesting question. Should there be high art in small places? Well, yeah, without question, there should be.
Mike, let's explore that last little sentence there. Should there be high art in small places? Why did you want to make a documentary about a subject like that?
When cinematographer and my co-director, Marius Anderson, and I were planning the film, that's what we wanted to kind of dig into. And we were so happy to meet the person who said that in the clip was Vita Zaponczyk, and she's the director of the Northern Lights Music Festival. And when we met her, she kind of had the same thoughts that we had, that, you know, just because we live in these small towns doesn't mean we don't listen to public radio and we listen to the operas on Saturdays and think about things like that. And we were really excited about exploring this part of the world where there's still a mix of, you know, there's a mix of people's like political backgrounds, their beliefs. You know, I think in America now, we think that the urban, you know, people think one way and rural people think another way. And I just, you know, I don't find that to be true when I'm moving around the state and interviewing people. You know, we have multitudes. People are complex. And so there's no reason we can't have things like opera that might seem like sort of a big city thing. There's no reason we can't have those in small towns.
Yeah, well, and even within just that few seconds of that clip, we hear from a kid with a thick Finnish accent, and he has spent most of his life in Minnesota. But then we also hear from a young transgender student. And then throughout the film, which we don't see in that particular clip, is that you hear from some Ojibwe people who are teaching their cultural practices and bringing in the music that was here far longer than the opera and the other music that the immigrants brought with them. And just seeing all of that come together, and again, in such a tiny town, were you at any point just like, really? All of this? There's hardly anyone here. And this is so reflective of the actual diversity of this country.
Yeah. I mean, we hoped that we would find kind of a diversity of people and opinions as we started doing this. But you never really know. We were constantly delighted to find, like I was saying before, how complex people are and how, you know, it's sort of beyond my dreams as a documentary filmmaker to be able to find an Ojibwe language instructor who's trained in opera.
Yeah.
And this is a guy named Ryan and Bajan, and he gives such a great interview in the middle of the film where we were with him as he's helping some kids build these ricing sticks because they're going to go out ricing. And I say, you know, this is kind of, you know, unexpected to find you out here today and then later on you're going to be, you know, rehearsing for the opera. And he just kind of stopped me in my tracks and was just like, you know, we can be more than one thing. And that's what the movie's about. People who are more than one thing. You know, you've got him. You've got this kid, Steve Sokola, with the deep voice that you mentioned. He makes his living as a one-man band. He travels all around the world playing his accordion and his, you know, cymbal on top of his head. But he was trained in the opera. You know, there's the transgender kid who I don't think end up being in the opera, but he's a high school kid now who's really getting into making the scenery. So just so many interesting people.
You know, what you said there, we can be more than one thing, quoting one of your guests on the documentary. Why do you think we try to pretend that we're not?
I think about this all the time. It's easier to belong to a group and feel like you are, you know, a part of a little club, and you know, a lot of times that's political, but other times it's religious or, you know,
safety in numbers kind of thing.
It is. It's just easier to define yourself as a thing and then not think about how complicated all people are. I don't know. It's a tough question.
We're visiting today with Mike Schultz, the creative force behind Iron Opera. It is showing Thursday at 9 o'clock Central right here on Prairie Public. You can find out more about Mike at MikeSchultz.com, and that's S-C-H-O-L-T-Z. And as you're scrolling through the website, you might see Prairie Public's own Matt O'Lean, as he was featured in one of Mike's documentary Rip List, which was a delightful watch. I remember watching that a few years ago. Mike, the opera comes with a very different kind of talent to be able to sound, you know, like this. Definitely not a voice that the rest of us have, but there's also this idea that, you know, sometimes with talent comes a little bit of creative differences. And I'm going to play another couple clips here from Iron Opera. And this is just a tech rehearsal, and it sounds, well, this is a rehearsal, and it sounds like things are going just fine.
So you guys leave this space open.
Okay.
So when everybody walks in the room, you close in as much as you can. Gabby, can we have big rehearsal? 57 is when the carriage enters.
And then it pretty quickly turns into this.
That's where Chia, you have to start the tech. You have to
We're
start
teching.
The tech. The designers need to see the show
teching.
From beginning
Peter,
to end.
What the hell are you think we're doing?
We're out at 10:30, it's 8:48.
Peter, please stay away. Going back, this is the first time I see the horses. This is called teching, as far as I'm concerned.
The designers need to see the show so they can rehearse the changes.
And that ending there was sort of the classic throw something down on stage and stomp off here. Did any of the people featured in the documentary ever try to say, no, you can't include stuff like that?
So Vita Zupancic told us right up front, you have freedom to shoot anything you want, show anything you want. And I said, well, you know, we need conflict in a documentary, and I've done some creative endeavors in my life, so I assume there's going to be arguments at some point. And she said, yeah, that's fine. That's part of the process. So we went up there, you know, almost every day for about 3 weeks leading up to the opening night. And every day we would talk to the people there and say, okay, is today the day when people are going to, you know, start throwing a fit? And they would laugh and say, no, we're cool. It's okay. But then a few of them would pull me aside and say, don't worry, it's coming. It always happens. Someone coming. Will, you know, they're passionate people and they feel strongly about things, and there will be creative differences at some point. And so, you know, this happened 2 days before opening night at the tech rehearsal, and we were secretly delighted. I think a lot of people in the room were mortified that we were catching all of this on camera. But we were, you know, happy to see it because it's part of the creative process.
Well, yeah, talk about that thing, because a lot of people don't undertake endeavors like putting on an opera in a small town or making a documentary about an opera in a small town. Like the will, the drive, the passion. And yeah, sometimes when those things get a little bit heated, what is, I guess, just your process for how to deal with the fact that you have to have a certain amount of fire to pull off something like that?
Yeah.
And if you don't have the fire, maybe you're never going to run into the conflict, but
maybe we
won't start anything either.
We also have sort of the specter of the ticking clock. Mm. And the documentary is scheduled, you know, 18 days before the opera, you know, and then we move ahead to 12 days before the opera, and then finally it's day by day. And I cannot believe how quickly they put these operas together, because the main cast just shows up like 2 or 3 weeks before opening night.
Yeah.
They're, of course, the opera company is working on it for, you know, 5, 6, 7 weeks ahead of time. And they're getting like the chorus members together, and they start working with them a little bit. But the main cast, I think, showed up on this one maybe 10, 12, 14 days ahead of time. And, they managed to put it all together that quickly. So when you've got that sort of ticking clock, and time is always your enemy, and I think that's what leads to some of the conflicts. And you hear that in the clip you played, is they only have like an hour and a half to go through this 2 hour plus show two nights before it opens. They just don't have time for everything.
Yeah. What's your process as a documentary filmmaker for being able to catch people, though, in, and I don't mean catch as in a gotcha, but just, you know, you have to be kind of a wallflower, which is really hard to do when you're filming things. What is it about you that allows people to be themselves?
Yeah, I think, you know, the ideal, I think people assume the ideal is that as a documentary filmmaker, you are just a fly on the wall, or you're in the background. But you sort of have to develop a relationship with the people you're filming. You have to become friends with them. And it's weird. I've actually become really close friends with a lot of the subjects of my documentaries and still hang out with them to this day. I sometimes say it's the only way I know how to make friends as an adult.
Oh, I feel
is
that.
To make a documentary film about someone that I find interesting.
I interview people, Mike.
It's the way it works. It's hard to find the time to make friends. And so, we'll show up early and we won't even film that much that's interesting the first couple days. We're kind of just hanging out with people. And so by the time, you know, some of the really interesting stuff happens, you're literally just hanging out with your friends. And oops, you know, some of them start arguing, or some of them say something really funny, and you happen to have the camera constantly rolling. It's the Heisenberg principle. You can't help affecting the documentary that you're making with your very presence.
And the documentary, again, is called Iron Opera. It is showing Thursday at 9 o'clock Central right here on Prairie Public. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was fun.
And we are going to play just a tiny bit more from Iron Opera.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, snakes.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens, Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, serving the Bismarck-Mandan area from homes and ranches to rental properties. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. When you think about the flora and fauna of the great outdoors, easy to enjoy things like bunnies and deer and birds. Not everyone likes snakes, but here's one you maybe haven't even heard of. Here is a Natural North Dakota essay from biologist Chuck Lura.
I recently perused the Amphibians and Reptiles of North Dakota webpage. It's a collaborative effort between North Dakota State University, North Dakota Game and Fish Department, University of Minnesota Bell Museum, and HerpMapper. They list 8 species of snakes documented in the state. I assume that most North Dakotans are familiar with many of these snakes, but I suspect that few have ever heard of or seen a smooth green snake. They may be found over much of North Dakota, but more so west of the Red River Valley. It's a species of grasslands, meadows, open woods, and other similar habitats, often with some open water nearby. These snakes are small, colorful, and quite docile. Resting in the grass, they resemble a lime-green, wavy-shafted pencil. The adults are generally a smooth, bright green with a pale yellow underbelly and between 1 and 2 feet long. They're interesting animals, and perhaps there is something about their jaw structure that makes them look like they're smiling when one can get a good look at them. If they had 4 legs, they would certainly be a star of a television commercial. Smooth green snakes are rather opportunistic predators, with the bulk of their diet consisting of insects, spiders, worms, and the like. And although they find shelter and protection in rodent burrows, they are known to fall prey to a variety of predators, including raccoons, foxes, weasels, hawks, owls, and herons. It's worth noting that the smooth green snake is listed as a species of concern in several states and is listed as vulnerable in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. The North Dakota Game and Fish Department has it listed as a species of conservation priority level 1. Population declines often list habitat loss as a factor, and because they feed heavily on insects, they're both directly and indirectly vulnerable to the widespread use of insecticides. If you have an aversion to snakes, make an effort to at least become a little more familiar with the smooth green snake. You may well even find a new friend. And if you carefully catch and hold one, it might even smile at you. I've put links to more information on North Dakota reptiles and amphibians, as well as the smooth green snake, along with a text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, a movie review from Matt O'Lean as he takes a look at the latest in the Mad Max saga. And we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson. That's right after this.
If you really want to know what's going on in this country ahead of the election next year, you've got to get away from the extremes and listen to the middle.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I'm calling you from Atlanta, Georgia.
On my new live national call-in show, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, we'll elevate the voices of Americans who need to be part of our national conversation.
Hi, Jan, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Join me every week for The Middle with Jeremy Hobson.
The Middle. Listen Fridays at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain on Prairie Public.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away With Words.
I think the best thing about the audience is all of these voices that don't get heard. These accents, these regional dialects, the old expressions from the grandmother, or the way people speak in Alaska or Maine or Hawaii, or heck, we get calls from Australia and where else? We've had calls from Japan.
And what I love about it is that our callers teach us.
That's right.
All the time. They bring us their linguistic heirlooms.
Yeah.
They bring us the slang that they've heard that we haven't heard before.
Yeah, and one piece of jargon in our workplace that we can share with the world is we call certain kinds of calls tellers, because
mm-hmm.
the caller is telling us things that we didn't know. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away With Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
All right, that means it's time to talk to news director Dave Thompson about the week's biggest stories. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ashley. How are you?
I'm not too bad. You know, the school season is pretty much over. Most people wrapped up before Memorial Day. A few schools wrapping up, well, basically today.
Yeah.
One school wrapped up forever, it seems like. This was in Edmore. It graduated its final class of seniors over this past weekend.
And you saw it was only two,
a mere
right?
Two, yes. I wondered immediately about the valedictorian-salutatorian relationship there. So this was a nice profile piece from our Danielle Webster, and I encourage listeners to go to prairiepublic.org if they didn't get a chance to hear the story. But let's just talk a little bit about what a school means to a small town in North Dakota.
It means an awful lot because, you know, the old saw is towns need a school, a church, and a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got the school closing in Edmore, but they want to find a way to repurpose the building, which is a good idea. But, you know, it really was a very booming school back in the days when they were putting missiles in, you know, the missile defense was going in, and they had that silo that was built in Tacoma.
Yeah.
So, and then that started to fade a little bit and faded further as you went into the 80s and 90s, and now you've got 17 students in that school and two graduates.
Yeah, interesting how the boom and bust cycle, you know, around here you usually think ag or oil, and then this was like, oh, missiles.
That's right.
That's a different kind of boom and bust indeed.
And you basically compare that to Williston and Watford City, where the oil boom was going on,
mm-hmm.
and how they really grew in enrollment, had to redo some schools, add some new schools, that type of thing.
Yeah. So two graduated out of these 17. Where will the remaining 15 go next year?
That's a very good question. There are several options, including others that are closer to Devil's Lake. I don't think they have decided yet where they're going to go, but it might be, given a choice, you might go where you think is closest to your home, I suppose.
And then does that mean there's busing, or are these students going to be in charge of their own transportation?
You know, that I don't think we know at this point, but I would not doubt if there's going to be busing.
Are there other schools that seem like they might close in the near future?
Haven't heard of many, but you know, you hear about the smaller schools. Like, there used to be a one-room school that was in the Badlands, and it was down to about five students. I don't know if that school is still going. So if they feel they want to keep the school going, they will. But in Edmore, it just didn't make any economic sense anymore.
You have a story this week, Dave, on higher education, and specifically tenure here.
Right, and this just came up, and it's been a discussion. If you remember back to the last legislative session, 2023, there was a bill that would have eventually gotten rid of tenure at Dickinson State University and Bismarck State College as a pilot project. Well, that was defeated. Now there's been a discussion on the Board of Higher Education called the Post-Tenure Ad Hoc Committee, and it's not necessarily going to say we're going to end tenure, but what do we change, and what happens after somebody gets tenure in the system, and how easy it is for a person to be removed from that person's position if a person has tenure. So there's a lot of discussion going on right now. The thing that came out of the Board of Higher Education is that there's a general agreement that tenure is a valuable thing, but that maybe there needs to be a little bit more leeway given to college presidents. There was one suggestion, by the way, that maybe at the community colleges, the two-year schools, that maybe there'd be a 50% recommendation for new hires, that you would hire people, about half the new hires would not be offered a tenure track.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I've heard arguments on both sides of this here. One of the main arguments for tenure is that a lot of professors' responsibilities are actually about publishing papers and not so much about teaching. Obviously, they are teaching. And the argument there is that they can actually produce more of the research that they actually sort of want to. They can take more risks and everything because they don't have to worry about getting fired.
Right. If that's the academic freedom argument.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. But on the other side of that is that sometimes tenured professors aren't maybe as eager, as active, or if they are employing any kind of bad behavior, especially as it comes to relating to students, you know, there's not as much power for firing them there. So the argument on the flip side is that they're overprotected.
That's right. That is an argument that's made. But I could also say that even if you are a tenured faculty member, you can get removed from your job for certain misconduct.
Yeah.
It just takes a little bit longer to, you know, work its way through the appeals process and things like that. Now, the professors who are tenured say that does protect us from retaliation by college presidents. That's another argument, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. There's going to be more discussion on this.
Yeah, I would imagine. The Industrial Commission has okayed a study of a regional EV infrastructure resiliency plan. Now, I've heard that it's fairly easy to take electric vehicles up and down the coasts of the country, but not so much down the middle.
Right, because cold weather zaps power out of batteries. So that's the comment.
And we don't have as many recharging stations.
That's right. That we are seeing more of them. Mm-hmm. And the theory behind this study is, yeah, that will be more and more being added to North Dakota's highways. And how do we make sure that, you know, there's enough power to get to those charging stations and enough power in the chargers themselves to make sure that the cars can run? So there's going to be a study. EERC up at the University of North Dakota is going to be leading the study, and it's going to involve Montana and some of the tribal nations about what needs to be done, what you consider to be resiliency.
Yeah, do we know kind of who's on the forefront of these newer, longer-lasting types of batteries?
Well, I know that, well, Tesla's got its own battery system.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. I do know that there are Tesla charging stations and there are charging stations for other EVs, and there are some even around the Bismarck and Fargo areas. So the idea is, you know, what are you going to need to make sure that, you know, a car doesn't break down in the middle of winter and it's 35 below?
Yeah, that is definitely bad news bears. There is an interesting story. Now might be a good time to shop for insurance coverage. That's, you know, I'm used to hearing, oh, Memorial Day weekend, you can wear white again, but not, oh, let's go shop for insurance coverage. Okay, not about Memorial Day weekend, but the timing is sort of strange here.
It is kind of strange, but if you think about it, and this is the insurance commissioner, John Gottfried, had talked about this, that he's getting some concerns from people who are especially homeowners, saying their homeowner insurance is going up. But he says if you look at what's been happening with inflation and with some of the natural disasters around the country, for every dollar, he said, that the insurance companies bring in premium, they're paying out $1.12. So you can go broke fairly fast on that. There are some insurance companies that have lost billions of dollars because they insured places where there were some very natural disasters, things like that, and they have to cover it because that's what their insurance companies do. They cover these kinds of losses. So he said, yeah, you can see some of that, and the premiums might be higher, but you might be able to find a better deal if you shop around. So that's what he said.
Has there been any concern about stopping coverage because it's too expensive?
That's a darn good question. I do not know the answer to that. But that's a good one to follow up on.
Is anybody thinking outside the box here? I'm just even thinking, spitballing here, deep-rooted plants that can help flood mitigation or soil erosion in a way that just lawns aren't necessarily doing. Has anybody put ideas out for, like, hey, you can get coverage at a different rate if you start doing some other kinds of measures with your house?
You know, that might not be a bad idea. I haven't really heard too much about that, but yeah, if that's a possibility, then that lowers the risk to insurance company, that lowers your risk of potential flooding or other damage.
Yeah, I mean, you hear about things like tax credits for solutions that maybe don't cost as much to heat your house. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So there is something, and that's worth exploring too. Thank you for the story idea.
All right. We check in with Dave Thompson once a week. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around, everybody.
Hi, I'm Jack Zaleski. I'm the former editorial page editor and a current columnist for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and I've been a newspaper man for life. But no matter what the media and public radio is included, journalism is a vital pillar of democracy. We're seeing what happens with a superpower whose leader goes unchecked by a free and independent press. We've seen democracy and the media under attack right here in this country. It is always important to support your trusted sources of journalism. So keep reading and subscribing to your area newspapers, digital or in print. Become a member of your local public radio station, Prairie Public. And we journalists will continue to seek the truth no matter what we uncover.
Hi, I'm Tom Brusseau. I hope you'll join me every Saturday for the Great American Folk Show. You'll hear plenty of live music from across the spectrum of genres and from around the world. And we also feature artists and craftspeople, poets and storytellers, and there's always a current of North Dakota that flows through the program. You'll feel a real sense of place as you get to know our eateries and our writers and historians, and even in some cases, our historical reprisers. The Great American Folk Show airs every Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
When you hear the fanfare, that means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt O'Lean. Matt, the movie Furiosa. This is a Mad Max saga, and I watched the trailer for this. It's about 2.5 minutes with, you know, fewer than 24 words in it. So I feel like it's a fair thing to say. This is the kind of movie where if you're interested in stunts and special effects, but not necessarily plot and dialogue, you know, maybe a little bit more on that end. Very action oriented.
I don't know why I'm doing this review. You just said it all in far less words. That's all. We'll see you next week. That was very accurate, Ashley. Yes, so this is the fifth Mad Max movie, and this is sort of a prequel backstory to Mad Max Fury Road, which came out in 2015. So this is the Charlize Theron character, Furiosa, but we track her from a little girl through grown-up Anya Taylor-Joy, who plays her in this. So this is a prequel about 20 years or 15 years before Charlize Theron takes over the Furiosa character. So, yes, the stunts are, they have to be seen to be believed. The stunts in Fury Road were some of the best I've ever seen in my life. These are equally amazing with, you know, tanker trucks and grappling things, and it's just crazy, the stunt work in this movie. The makeup, the costuming is just off the charts amazing. That is the reason to go to this movie. So this again takes place in a vast futuristic desert wasteland of Australia, again before the Charlize Theron Tom Hardy movie Fury Road. So if you just back time about 15 years from that, you've got it. So in this wasteland, the little girl, Furiosa, kind of lives in this sort of semi-paradise where there's actually, they can grow food, they can grow plants, there's water, and that is not the norm outside of this. So through a series of events, she gets captured by Dementus and his gang. Dementus is played by Chris Hemsworth in his first villain role, and he really chews the scenery in this part. So they want to know where the paradise is. How do you find this? And the little girl, you know, doesn't tell. So there's a lot of exposition in this movie. So when I say exposition, all say about the plot, and the plot is a little bit confusing as to who's fighting who. Basically, all you need to know, Ashley, is in this wasteland, there's a battle for water, food, and gasoline. Those are the three key things that all of these gangs, these biker gangs and truck gangs, that's what they want. So that's basically the plot. And the little girl, of course, you know, grows up to be Furiosa. I wanna let people know, Anya Taylor-Joy doesn't appear till about 50 minutes into this movie. So that's a risk.
And it's named and Furiosa.
It's, and it's named Furiosa, but okay. she's a small girl too, different okay. actress. So it's a risk to hold your star back for that long. And I will get into that in a minute, which could be the reason that it didn't do great at the box office. And we'll get into that too, Ashley. But they hold her back for a long time. So Hemsworth, you know, chews the scenery for the first hour of the movie. So there's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of stunts. That's essentially the plot of the movie. A lot of exposition. I did think the film was too long at 2 hours and 28 minutes. So maybe that exposition of the first hour could have been cut back.
Who can sit for that
2:28,
long?
Yeah. But as you said in your very accurate 15-second review, if you love stunts and great makeup and costume work and trucks and motorcycles. And the motorcycles are loud. They're loud in this movie. So see this on the big screen for sure if you can. If you like that, it's really good. It's not as good as Fury Road, but it's really a solid action movie. I will say that the Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, their chemistry in Fury Road might be the reason that Fury Road is a better movie. Because you know, Hemsworth is the villain. And Anya Taylor-Joy is the hero. So there's not this, you know, chemistry that there was between Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. That could have had an impact on this movie. But overall, I liked it. The critics liked it for the most part.
Do you need to have seen any of the other Mad Maxes for this to make sense?
I think seeing Fury Road makes sense. You don't need to go back to the Mel Gibson stuff, but seeing Fury Road, which won a bunch of Oscars in the technical categories, if there was a stunt work Oscar, it would have won that as well in 2015. And let me just tip the hat to George Miller, the director who's now 78 years old, who's directed all the Mad Max movies. He's still vibrant and young. And he directed this movie, and few directors outside of Sam Peckinpah in the old days can direct action pictures quite like George Miller can. So again, a tip of the hat to George Miller. He knows how to pull off these stunts. There's an extended chase scene in the middle of this movie through the desert that goes on for like 10 minutes. You never take your eyes off the screen. It is crazy, the stunt work going on. And the War Boys, those are the characters that have the white war paint on.
Yeah.
They're involved in that scene. It's just crazy. Tom Burke has a big part in this movie, too, which I won't tell you too much about, but you'll have to go see the movie.
It's interesting to me the combination of the fact that this belongs to a franchise and it has a name like Chris Hemsworth mm-hmm. attached to it, that you said earlier that it didn't actually do very well at the box office.
$32 million domestic.
Does nobody want to see such a hot guy play such a villain?
I don't know. You know, that's a good question. I love how your phrasing's today. $32 million only at the domestic. This film cost $160 million to make, so it's going to have to really work hard worldwide. This is the great question of Memorial Day weekend. What happened with Furiosa? Why did it not do Fury Road business? Because it's a franchise. It could be that Hemsworth is the villain. It could be, like I said, the Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron chemistry in the first movie really kind of helped. I think there was more character development in the first movie than this one. Anya Taylor-Joy, she's a big star, but she hasn't really opened a movie on her own. She's been part of some big movies, of course. I'm not going to put this on her because she's really good in the movie. She barely speaks in the movie. It's all in those gigantic, beautiful eyes of hers. And she's a bad, bad woman in this movie. And what I mean by that is she can handle herself action-wise. So it all works on those things. But I just wonder if the fact that she's at odds with Chris Hemsworth, and you're going to have to see the movie to know why she is at odds with Chris Hemsworth. I said he's the villain. That's all I'm going to say. But just understand that these two are going to have it out. And so there's not that chemistry because they are on opposing sides. Sure. That could be part of it. But this was the weakest Memorial Day weekend box office for movies since 1995. So it barely beat the Garfield movie at the box office. So I'm not sure if the length, but, you know, people since COVID, Ashley, there is this trend of I'm going to wait and see it on streaming. And there is that. I've noticed this with younger friends of mine who are not going to the theaters anymore. So is this a blip? Is this something to worry about? You know, replicating the Barbenheimer phenomenon of last summer is going to be tricky. So we'll see if this is a trend this summer and if this is going to be a really bad summer for movies at the box office. Not sure. But it's a good movie. So the critics like it better than the amount of people that were going to see it. And I did like the movie, but it's not as good as Fury Road.
You know, I wonder, you're talking about this home theater thing, and I'm thinking about how good and how easy it is to watch a movie at home anymore these days. But like you were saying, like the stunts are so good, the motorcycles are so loud, like you want to see this on the big screen with a huge amount of things. Are you seeing a trend towards more and more of those films being made to try to get people back into the theater?
Top Gun Maverick pulled it off, but but that had Tom Cruise.
That had Tom Cruise
and a cameo by Val Kilmer that a lot of us were waiting to see how Val would speak, you know, with his throat cancer. So I don't know. I do think viewing habits have changed. COVID changed people, and it changed their viewing habits. But a film like this, you would have thought it would have done about $50 million over a three-day, really four-day weekend, and it only did $32 million. Yeah. So the jury's out on Furiosa, but it's a worthwhile film to see. I love Anya Taylor-Joy. I love Chris Hemsworth as a bad guy, but we'll see if this is if this portends bad news for the summer box office.
Well,
but
I'm
your 15-second review at the beginning was perfect.
Yeah, but mine didn't have the word portend
okay.
in it. So.
I do like that word.
All right, some Oscar trivia. Chris Hemsworth is Australian.
He is.
Who is the most decorated Australian when it comes to the Oscars?
Is it Kate Blanchett with her two Oscars?
It is not.
It is not. Okay,
not a household name.
So this
it's
is
a little
this
unfair.
Is more of a technical type
not
person.
Not technical, but in the costume and production design end of things.
Costume design, production design, Australian. Is it Colleen Atwood?
Nope.
She's English, I think. Oh, I thought that was a good
guess. All right, I'm gonna switch tactics. I'm going to give you the name and then have you give the films here. So her name is Catherine Martin. She's gotten four Oscars.
Lord of the Rings?
In 01 film, 02 Oscars.
Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. No?
No.
Moulin Rouge.
Okay. And then 2012 film, 2013 Oscars.
So she got a costume and production.
Costume and production design for that, too.
2012 film.
Starring Leonardo DiCaprio, I think.
2012 film, Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't know if he's in that or not. The one I'm thinking of here. King's Speech? No, that's 2010. That's wrong. I don't know.
The Great Gatsby.
Oh, The Great Gatsby. That's right. I didn't care for that version, so that's why I didn't think of that. Yeah, DiCaprio's in that.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 30th. The American West underwent major changes in the early 1900s. Cities and towns were springing up. Railroads crisscrossed the countryside, and fences put land off limits to public use. The federal government also established forest reserves. Grazing livestock in these areas required a permit. In an effort to avoid paying for permits, some livestock owners moved their herds from place to place in search of grazing and water. This was common for sheep herders. Sheep arrived on the northern Great Plains when North Dakota was still part of Dakota Territory. In 1883, rancher Dugald Campbell brought 1,300 sheep to his ranch south of Bismarck. The Bismarck Tribune observed that the soil, climate, and grasses of this region are peculiarly adapted to sheep culture. A few ranchers in western North Dakota tried their hand at raising sheep, but it never caught on like raising cattle and horses. On this date, in 1902, the Bismarck Daily Tribune alerted readers to sheep coming in from other states to graze on North Dakota grass. Herders who were dubbed tramp sheepmen were bringing large herds into the state and turning them loose to graze. Coming from out of state and moving their herds around allowed them to avoid paying state taxes like local sheep herders. The state took the incursion seriously. Arrest warrants were issued for sheepmen who failed to notify the sheep inspector 5 days in advance of their arrival, as required by law. And the county treasurer of Billings County seized a large herd, advertising them for sale at 50 cents a head. The sheepmen responded by hiring lawyers. Judge Amidon issued a restraining order halting the sale until the matter could be sorted out. North Dakota sheep ranchers said sheep coming from other states destroyed the grass and had the potential to bring disease. The so-called tramp sheep were resented, considered a constant source of trouble, but the authorities had not successfully prevented them from coming. Gradually, the practice died out on its own. Today, cattle greatly outnumber sheep in North Dakota, with over 1.5 million cattle to about 500,000 sheep. But sheep ranching still plays an important role in the state's economy. Today's Dakota Daybook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street on today's All Things Considered, a look at what is going on in the world of sports as we hear from the president of the NCAA on the growth of women's sports and big payouts in collegiate sports. Monday on Main Street, another in our series of political interviews as we head into the primary season, as we hear from the superintendent of public instruction, Kirsten Baszler. That's Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day and your weekend.